Nice to see everyone. I was thinking about what do I want when I give a talk? And I think I always want more or less the same thing, which is for all of us to see, to experience, to taste, to know, but not intellectually, but to know in here somehow, how vast we are, how unknowable we are, how beautiful we are. Because the earth is vast, the earth is unknowable, the earth is beautiful, and we are the earth. So anything else I say is just to see if I can help deepen that sense in you that you are vast, unknowable, and beautiful. And I thought I would talk about three very short koans from this collection called the Miscellaneous Collection. It's in the Harada Yasutani lineage and is sort of kept alive and active in the Sambo Kyoden and the Diamond Sangha lineages. It's kept alive in me. I love these cases. And now you're going to help keep it alive too. So I'll share it with you, and maybe some of these words will resonate with you and actually really alter how you perceive yourself in the world and how you interact with the world. And I actually don't know that I would be here at Santa Cruz Zen Center and be a priest and be in this position had I not studied these. Maybe I would, but maybe I wouldn't. So I have a lot of gratitude to this collection. This is a collection of 30 koans. And the last three are attributed to Beiling Xiao Jian, his three turning words. There's actually slightly more than three, which is very typical. Three and then like one point A, one point B. But I'm just going to take the very last three sentences. And the first one is, the clearly enlightened person falls into a well. I feel like I actually fall into wells quite often. Probably you all do too. Nearly fell into a well a couple of times over the last few days when people said, how was your fourth? And I didn't know how to answer, how was my fourth of July? Got to respect where they're coming from, want to respect Indigenous people whose lives were lost when this country was formed and all the injustice that happens right up to this moment, but also respect the people that this is a beautiful land with wonderful people and wonderful things. So I don't think I quite fell into a well, but I nearly did a couple of times. So if you imagine a well like an old-fashioned circular brick well, very deep that you can't climb out of, maybe on a sort of open grassland that's dry, not much water, not many people, and you fall into that well. So your prospects of climbing out are pretty much zero. So what would an ordinary person do if they fell into a well? My guess is there's a bunch of things. You might have some ideas of what you would do. Probably they would shout, hey, get me out, hello, hello, anybody there? Something like that. They might do that for a while. They might go into denial and say, it'll be fine, someone will come and find me. And they'll just sit there, trying to convince themselves it'll all be fine, and be quite relaxed. but actually be in denial of their circumstance, and then at some point they'd get quite depressed because nobody is coming. They might try to desperately try to climb out even though it's futile and just keep on trying. That would be another thing. And they might also decide to accept their circumstance and just sit there and go, oh, okay, this is it, this is my lot in life. It looks like I'm not going to live more than a couple of days. So the koan is an awakened, an enlightened person falls into a well. I wonder what would be different for an enlightened person falling into a well. And I think that they would probably do two of the things that an everyday person would do. They would shout, hello, hello, anybody there? I don't want to die today. Please come and get me out of this well. And they might kind of also realize that nobody may come. And then they would sit peacefully in the bottom of the well. And maybe what they would do is not just sit there waiting. Maybe they would sit there and be putting out sort of caring thoughts about everybody else. I hope everyone's going to be okay. I hope people's lives go well. I hope all the plants get enough water and the animals get enough food. You know, they might use whatever energy they have right to the very last moment, actually having thoughts like that, very connective thoughts, because they would understand that they are not just this separate person at the bottom of the well, that they are part of something very vast. And so they would be attending to the vastness of themselves outside of that well while they're in the bottom of the well. One of the reasons I really like that koan is it's got both a very energetic part to it and a very accepting part. And there's times when we need to just be accepting, and there's times when we need to be really energetic. So I like that case because it really captures both those sides, that an enlightened person can be very energetic and an enlightened person can be very peaceful and accepting. So sometimes they try to change circumstances and sometimes they don't try and change circumstances. But either way, they accept the reality in the first instance. Actually, before I do the next one, there was a comment in the back here. About these final turning words in this collection. It says that Yun Men responded when he heard them, on the anniversary of my death, just recite these three turning words and you will have repaid my kindness in full. It's a very big compliment. So as simple as that line is, an enlightened person falls into a well, there's a lot in there that you can spend time with. Just spend time with it. That's what's so great about koans, is you can memorize them and just spend time with them, let them spend time with you while you're going about your daily tasks, rather than thinking about repetitive random things that aren't really serving you or anybody else. So they're great that way, as are just any of the lines out of our sutras, just taking a line and reciting it to yourself and contemplating its meaning. I did have this thought of not using any notes because I was thinking, there is no security in this world. So I could give my talk with no notes and experience that insecurity. And I really got that lesson from Satya, who visited here a few years ago from Portland. I had a conversation with him and he pointed out that there was no security. And his words penetrated me. I think I've mentioned it in here before, those words penetrated me. At any moment, somebody's words can penetrate you in a way that transforms you from that point onward in how you see the world. Those words that he said to me over tea and cookies in the community room impacted me so that I've changed my attitude to all sorts of things ever since. It wasn't casual. It was sort of casual, but it was backed with his practice. So I heard those words really well. So anyway, I nearly didn't bring my notes, and then I thought, maybe next time. So the second koan is, what is the blown hair sword? Or for some reason in my mind I often turn it round to, what is the hair blown sword? I don't think it really matters. The term is describing a sword that's edge is so sharp that just if a hair floated past and landed on it, it would be sliced in two. So it is a sword whose edge is so sharp that it would cut anything. So when I think about that, I think of how incredibly thin it would have to be at that spot where it could cut something so easily. So one way of thinking about this sentence, this question, what is the blown hair sword, is to ask, well, I wonder what it is, and to contemplate what it might be. And what is good about this process is you can come up with multiple answers, multiple responses, and they'll probably all be beneficial for you and for me to consider, you know, what this image might be pointing to. It might be pointing to one thing more so than other things, but that's okay. Multiple different ways in which you can take the teachings and relate it to this image will all be beneficial. So one of the ways that I think of it is, this edge is, it's like this present moment, but this moment, we can't even quite find it. It's so, the edge is so thin, so thin, that we can't quite find it. But it does encourage us to be very present to this unknowable, ungraspable present moment that we can't pin down, but nevertheless, it's like things are always in a state of flux, constantly changing, and we call it moment, moment, moment. It's not. But this image is like, well, this moment that can't actually pin down, let's pay attention to it anyway. And I like that our clock that we have in here doesn't have a second hand that goes tick, tick, doesn't do that. It has something that I think reflects reality a little better, as it just moves like that. So I'm glad that that's how our clock is here. So last Saturday, there happened to be nothing happening here in the Zendo, and I, for some reason, happened to have nothing happening in my life. So I decided to sit in here for 6 hours and just see what that was like. And it turned out to be fairly uneventful. Nothing mind-blowing happened. I didn't kind of walk out, you know, suddenly. It was fairly uneventful, but it wasn't terrible either. Mm-hmm. It wasn't torturous. Although the very last half hour I noticed, the last half hour I started getting a little antsy, like, okay, I didn't look at my watch. I don't think I even wore my watch. I had a timer, which was good, 40 minutes of sitting, 5 or 10 minutes of kinhin. So it was very good doing that. I would recommend it if you haven't had this idea of just using your phone as a timer, because you don't have to look at anything. You just wait for it to make a little tink, tink, tink sound like that, and then you know it's time to get up. So I did that, and I was sitting actually where Kathy is sitting, and I had the window open and was looking outside. And out there is a comfrey plant. And really, I spent the 6 hours just being in communion with that comfrey plant. And I noticed that when I was looking at it, besides the obvious things like the wind blowing the leaves, I couldn't see any specific change occurring, but each time I'd come back and sit after Kinhin, I would notice something was different. And I'm describing all of this to talk about how change, there is continual change, even though we as humans can't see that change. So two of the leaves were touching the sidewalk for the first sit. And on the second sit, they kind of were still touching the sidewalk, but they had sort of lifted apart from each other, so there was a gap between them. And then the next sit, one of them had kind of raised up and was not touching the sidewalk anymore. And then the next sit, the other one wasn't either. And then the gap between them got larger. And over the 6 hours, there was about maybe an inch of movement, 3/4 of an inch of movement. I'm not sure if that movement was actually growing, that the country was getting larger. I think it was a mixture, because I checked it a couple of days later and it was still up off the ground. It might have been a mixture of just the day, that it was just getting more perky as the day moved along. From being kind of a little limp from the night time, it was just getting a little more up, waking up. But it moved. But I couldn't actually see the movement as it was happening. I could only register the movement by comparing it to something else periodically. And the other thing that was similar to that while I was sitting in here was, as I would do Kinhin, I would notice the temperature on our, we've got a little heater gauge over there, and each hour the temperature went up a degree. It started at 70, and by the time I finished it, it got to 76, I think, or maybe 77. I didn't feel it getting hotter, except one spot in the middle, I suddenly sort of went like, I need to open more windows. So I opened more windows. But I didn't feel myself getting warmer. I was the same. It felt like I was the same. Now I'm too hot, open the windows, same. But that isn't what was actually going on. Mm-hmm. What was going on was a gradual, continual rise in temperature over those 6 hours. It wasn't by one degree, then another degree. Like with the clock, it was just a continual movement. And so I found that what I ended up contemplating, I didn't have any plans for that time that I was sitting in here, but what I found myself contemplating as I noticed that over the first couple of hours was just the constantness of change. Just the constant change all the time. And we are just humans where we vibrate at a certain point so we can relate to other things that change at a rate similar to us. And we don't relate so well to things that change either way faster than us or way slower than us. We don't notice it. We don't register it. And I think we think it doesn't happen. I think we think things aren't really changing very much, but they're constantly, always changing. And I think the reason that that is actually a profound thing to contemplate is if everything is constantly changing, we can't pin anything down at any point in time ever, including ourselves. Anything that we don't like, anything we do like, we can just never pin it down. And actually, speaking of like and not like, I underlined my favourite line from one of our sutras. It just makes me laugh every time, quietly to myself, in the Zendo. Makes me laugh because I know it so well, and I'm sure you all know this line extremely well in your own life. I'll read a couple of lines before it and then tell you the one that I find really amusing. This is in Setting in Motion, the Wheel of Dharma. So the first bit doesn't sound very amusing at all, so don't worry about that. The noble truth of suffering is this: birth is suffering, aging is suffering, sickness is suffering, death is suffering, sorrow and lamentation, pain, grief and despair are suffering. Association with the unpleasant is suffering. Separation from the pleasant is suffering. Here's the amusing line. Not to get what one wants is suffering. In brief, grasping the five aggregates is suffering. So I've many times not got what I've wanted. Many times not got what I've wanted. One time I didn't get what I want to such an extent that I felt, you know, very, very much like it would be better if I wasn't alive. and I still never got the thing that I wanted, but I did slowly figure out how to come to acceptance of not getting that thing that I wanted so badly. And here I am still without the thing that I still want. Still don't have it. But I can even laugh about it now, which is pretty amazing. You know, it's another example of change. Change is constant. So even when we're in the grips of despair or anger, disappointment, happiness and excitement and satisfaction, all of it will change. So yes, so what is the blown hair sword? Just this moment, being attentive. I mean, it was wonderful to sit and just be with that comfrey plant for so long. I mean, I would never do it otherwise, except that I was in the Zendo. So recommend, if you've got a free weekend, check in with Kokyo if there's anything happening and just come in here and sit. It's great. So the last one is, each branch of coral holds up the light of the moon. Being a fairly visual person, I really like this case. Each branch of coral holds up the light of the moon. So I often sort of do this with my hands, holding my hands up as if they are branches of coral, like in the ocean, and the moonlight is coming through the water. We could think of like this line around the top of the Zendo as like the water, the surface, and the light of the moon comes through that and touches the coral, and the coral is holding it up. Coral is holding up the light of the moon, or we can do it with our face. The coral is holding up the light of the moon. And this is just a beautiful description of our interdependence. If there was no surface, the moonlight would just keep on going or wouldn't touch anything, couldn't become visible. It becomes visible when it touches something. And we're walking around all day holding up the light of the sun. I mean, as we walk around, like right now, we are holding up the light of the sun. As it comes in from outside and through these lights too, holding up old dinosaur bones, the energy of old dinosaur bones and trees and so on, the fossil fuels. In my garden next door, I've got cucumbers growing at the moment. So many, I started pickling them, which is feels really nice. But I did notice that about 2/3 of the little baby cucumbers are not getting fertilized by the bees. They're not turning into cucumbers. So 1/3 of them are, and 1/3 of them, they're tiny little things, and there's a flower on the end, and the bee has to go from one to the other, and it's not happening, and they're just withering up and dying. And I don't really know what the normal ratio is of how many cucumbers normally grow, but I do know that the bee population is crashing, and it may well be that I'm experiencing the effect of that right there in the garden, that I'm not getting as many cucumbers as I would have got 5 years ago if I'd planted them there, or maybe even last year. And just sitting there, I sit on my porch a lot, watching the bees and little flies and sometimes wasps, just watching them going around the garden, and occasionally butterflies and cabbage moths. I really, especially watching the bees going into the flowers, like making it possible for the zucchinis to grow, really getting this sense that if those bees die, our whole civilization is going to collapse. I mean, we need them for our food, I don't know what percentage of our food, but a lot of our food is dependent completely on bees. And it's just sitting there and thinking about, my goodness, that little creature that we tend to ignore in our culture is part of us, and we are part of it. It fertilizes the food that we then ingest. Then we defecate. In theory, we're supposed to defecate, and it goes back into the soil, which allows plants to grow and so on and so forth, to keep the bees, give them food to eat. But we're a bit disrupted. We don't do that so much now. We'll probably return to doing that, because we have to return to being part of a proper cycle where we're giving and receiving equally from all the other aspects of ourselves. So I was thinking about those bees, and then I felt a little bit sad about this koan. I love this. I remember studying this koan, and it gripped me. I just sat through a session just feeling like coral and just imagining the moon, like, for hours on hours and days and days. And at that time, it never occurred to me that there'd be something wrong for coral. But as probably everybody here knows, the coral reefs of the world are dying right now. Not just dying a little bit, they're dying a lot. In Australia, I think 60% of the coral reef, something like that. So we are the coral and we are the ocean. And it's not just that if the coral dies, we die because we need the oceans for food and because they affect the weather. If the corals die and the ocean dies, we die because we are those things. We are those things. It's not just that we need those things, we are those things. And this is something that you can't just know intellectually. This has to be felt somehow. I was just talking with Kokyo earlier about what word to use, and I use the word felt, but there might be better words. It needs to be experienced, maybe would be a better word. Needs to be tasted, that we are the bees, that we are the coral, that we are the ocean. It's not just that we need them, that we have this relationship. It's more than that. It's more than that. So these three koans, an enlightened person falls into a well. What is the blown hair sword? And each branch of coral holds up the light of the moon. The things that those lines can teach us, we can't learn it by just hearing it and trying to intellectually understand it. So then how do we really get to know what these words are? Same as the our sutras. How do those words become part of us so that they live with us 24 hours a day, even in our dreams? How do we do that? I think we do it, everyone has to find their own way, but some of the ways we do it is by doing zazen and quieting our minds, noticing the habits of our minds, and then being willing to want to undo some of those habits of our mind. And it does take work, it takes sweat. But it's not because we're trying to add something. It's not because we're trying to get something. It's because it takes a lot of effort to let go of our habits, our deluded habits. It just takes a really long time. We just have so many of them. It just takes a long time. But we do it in zazen, and I think it's really critical that we engage with a teacher and with Sangha members and with the teachings themselves, that we engage with them. So we can't just do it alone. We need to do it in community and with teachers who can check out how we're doing. And maybe this is easier to hear for people who are newer to the practice, and it might be harder to hear for those of us that have been practicing for a long time, because we can get a little bit used to the way we already do things, and we've maybe gained a certain amount of equanimity and comfort, and you know, we've already experienced some of the positive fruits of practice. But it's really important to not ever stop, you know, not to ever stop this process of being curious and being courageous enough to keep examining more closely, what are my habits that are being unhelpful to me? How can my practice deepen and become more subtle and more nuanced? And we can keep on having the sort of beautiful little surprises when a new insight kind of suddenly arrives in the mind. It's just so wonderful. And that never needs to stop. Like just that little time with the comfrey in me on Saturday, that will probably stay with me. There was something subtle about seeing the constant movement, knowing that the constant movement was happening, but that I couldn't actually register it. There was something about that experience of being humbled by seeing that change was occurring, but no matter how closely I looked, I couldn't see the change actually happening. But I knew it was, because I could, as I said, every hour or so I could notice something was different. Oh yes, I did have a thought too about it takes effort, sweat, time, creativity. We have to be open and curious and be willing to be creative with our minds, experiment a little bit, see what happens. Not get locked into fixed patterns and habits of doing things, even the way we do Zazen, you know. Try mixing it up a little bit. Courageous enough to be willing to dissolve in the end, to dissolve our identity of ourselves as a separate person, to have the courage to be willing to head in that direction. I also think it takes an imagination to imagine what would an awakened being look like, what would I look like as an awakened being, and to imagine, to try and imagine that. And the things that I tend to imagine is cheerfulness, kindness, being very present. Not, you know, you can tell the difference when someone is present or when they're kind of thinking about something else and their eyes are not really focusing on anything. Their eyes are focused internally on a story. So being present. What else? But they're the main characteristics that come to my mind, and then I just keep wanting, I move myself towards them, or I maybe move towards them, or I am ready to receive those qualities. You know, I'm ready to receive those qualities and ready for other people to do things that will help me receive those qualities. So then I have this last line, which is just sort of like a play on my new Dharma name. So we do not need to embellish this luminous goodness. We can naturally fall in love with this dream forest that is our life. Mm-hmm. Okay, I think that's all that I had down. Would anyone like to comment or ask questions? No.
Falling into the well, I imagine it very differently, mm-hmm. as more like the well as the source of water, of a blessing, and so the falling into the well is more like the dissolving that you were talking about. That's kind of how I perceive, you know, when you perceive that.
That's wonderful. Isn't that so great? So I'm just going to say this for the sake of the recording, that Yaro's had a different sense of the well, that it has water in it. See, I imagine a dry well. Isn't that interesting? Because it doesn't say. And there's an example of habits of mind. My habit of mind, unexamined, totally unexamined, habit of mind was that it would be a dry well. I don't know why, but that's what I exist. So that's a really good example. I had that habit of mind. I'm not saying yours is a habit of mind. But you had the image of falling into a well of water, and that is dissolving, and like the light, like, or falling back into the life force or something
nature.
Like that. Buddha nature, yes. Yeah, beautiful. Beautiful. Thank you. See, this was so wonderful. There's so many ways in which they can be of use to us. Yeah, thank you. Mary.
My perception was different than both of yours.
Uh-huh.
I saw it as a trap. You just can get so full of yourself. Oh, I'm just so enlightened now. Here you are, bottom of the well. Figure this one out.
Fantastic, yes. So I'm going to repeat that one too, that it could be like a trap. Falling into the well is like thinking, I'm so enlightened, and then you fall into the well like, uh-oh, reality. Reality comes to bite you. That's very good. That's great, because we all have to be careful of that, of sort of spiritual arrogance or even sort of complacency, a spiritual complacency. Thank you. Jamie.
I've asked myself a fair number of times what the Buddha meant by a week. And suddenly, 3 years ago, about three, maybe 2 years ago, I realized that I don't pay attention to myself. So there's now a project for me to pay attention to myself, and I was raised that I didn't matter, so it was clearly an habitual idea to pay attention to other people and not myself. What strikes me about your lecture, and what is striking me about these experiences and the specific way you were noticing the plant, the well, and the blade, has something to do with how to be curious when we don't know what the question is. And that's kind of where I am.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I realized that I don't pay attention to myself, I was 69 and I realized that. So it was pretty shocking that it never occurred to me in any serious way before that that's true. Even though I'd gone to various therapies and talked to people and discussed my family and all that stuff. So I guess I just wanted to make the comment that I appreciate the lecture, and yet it still seems a mystery to me. Often, if the Buddha says, be curious, right? I've always thought of myself as fairly curious people, but I could be more curious. The question comes to me, how do we know what to ask? Because you said, I'm going to ask myself how those leaves are moving. I'm going to ask myself what I want to think about the blade. It's just an amazingly challenging task in a way, and yet also easy. The question is, it seems to me, is whether we do it at all.
Mm.
How much we do it, right? Mm-hmm. Because what I didn't ever do was sit and ask myself whether I thought I mattered. It just never occurred to me. And if you have Harry Potter's invisibility cloak on all the time, but you don't see yourself, I'm a therapist, so I help a lot of other people, and they often have never asked themselves these questions, which now seem, either that one or a lot of other questions, seem very basic.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay.
So I just leave you with the issue of how do we know what the question is?
Yeah, so how do we know what the question is? And I think that's why we need teachers. It's when we need to talk to someone, because the question is different for everyone at different moments in time, the questions that we need to ask. A lot of them are similar, I think, but and you could also say we don't know what the question is. That's part of that deep not knowing about anything that's important for us to get used to inhabiting and not knowing about anything. At the same, I'm being open to noticing, and we know certain things from a relative perspective, and that's fine. But a deeper not knowing is really important to be comfortable with that. But lots of questions we can ask our teachers. And we do now have a Dokusan schedule up outside. Dokusan is where you meet with the teachers, and you can put your name up if you'd like to meet with any of our teachers and ask your questions. Mm-hmm. Or other senior practitioners here as well, and their names are listed there as well. Yes.
What would be an enlightened person, and kind of taking up imagination. Yeah, it's a very helpful way to just again step into practice moment by moment, and in a way drop some of the stories, pay more attention to another question, which is unknowable.
Thank you. Thank you.
When you talked about the temperature rising 1 degree an hour without noticing it, but seeing it register, I thought of the planet.
Oh, yes.
Very, very gradual.
Yes.
So unnoticeable that there are people who say it can't be happening. Or sometimes it's... I heard one politician talking about global warming on a cold day somewhere and said, we could use a little more global warming. Kind of like, it's cold today. It's a very kind of gross way of perceiving.
Yeah.
And yet, just like the Zendo temperature, without noticing, the effects are happening.
Yeah.
So you suddenly feel like, I have to open all the windows.
Yes.
Maybe that's where we're going with the planet.
Yes. So I was going to say for this, Kokyo just made that connection that the temperature rising in the Zendo is like the temperature rising on the planet, and that we don't notice it. And I have this tendency to watch on YouTube catastrophic events, and I watch them and see what people do, how they cope with floods, flash floods, tsunamis, that sort of thing. And climate change, or watch a lot of things to do with climate change. And what I have noticed is often with these sorts of changes, everything seems very normal. This is this thing of us not registering change. It seems very normal, and there's little signs of trouble, little signs, but they're only little, and then, bam, there's a big problem. I think that's the difficulty we've got with climate change. We're not particularly feeling it here. Some places are feeling it tremendously. Some places are really feeling it tremendously. But we're not. But we might suddenly. And from a practice perspective, from our bodhisattva vow, we need to be ready when, if and when that happens, something very dramatically painful for us, to be ready to be there to serve, to be of benefit at that moment. So I'm already doing mental preparation for that. So it doesn't have to be depressing. It can be like, it's just how it is. If it is how it is, it's how it is. And how can we start to imagine being practitioners under such circumstances? And what can we do to mitigate that already, not just wait for the catastrophe, but do the little bits that we can do? Do the little bits that we can do.
The bottom of the well with everyone.
Yes, the bottom of the well with everyone. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for making that connection. Any one last comment or question, and we'll stop for tea. Stan.
Some years ago, I'm not sure where we got it, but this saying on a refrigerator from Suzuki Roshi. So I think that someone asked him about what Buddhism is, and he said, change is just the way things are.
Change is just the way things are, yes. Yeah.
Kind of in a nutshell.
Well, I guess I want to somehow finish on something uplifting about all of this. I'm not sure what. It'll come to me. Hold on, let's see. I don't know. But deepening practice really does lead to joyfulness. It really does. So I hope all of us continue to practice diligently for each other and for the planet.
Yes. And that brings great joy.
That brings great joy. Okay, thank you. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Revelations are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma days are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable.